related somehow to reality, and then we'll go back to our theories in dreams and talk about berry phases. Before we get to berry phases, let's just look at some interesting experiments. As I said before, this field is exploding, but actually there are many more theory papers than experimental papers, because the material synthesis is only in the beginning stages. Let me start by the two-dimensional topological insulator. So we yesterday we looked at a model that showed the spin Hall effect. And this is a joint theory experiment paper, which I'm going to give reference to in the notes. And basically, the group here, the German group of Mollenkamp, is the only group so far that has been able to produce a two-dimensional topological insulator. And what they are doing is they're using a quantum well system. So basically, they sandwich mercury tellurite between cadmium tellurite in the two sides. And it turns out that interesting things happen. So if you look at the band structure of mercury tellurite and cadmium tellurite, they have similar bands, but they're kind of shifted away from each other. And when we build this quantum well, what we get is switching of the bands, which is pretty important. If you think of graphene, the reason we have an interesting wave function is because at the Dirac point, two bands cross each other. And if and the wave function, you could think of as being a combination, a linear combination of two original bands that maybe didn't talk to each other. So to get something interesting in a topological insulator, you need this band inversion. You also need strong spin orbit coupling. And this is a calculation of what you will find if you look at the band structure of the system, and it's similar to what you did in the tutorial session yesterday. And basically, you find many bulk bands. So this is collapsed on one of the directions. And you find also edge modes. So very similar to the Kane-Mellon model, but comes from a different type of system altogether. So this is on a square lattice. It just has that band inversion, and it has spin orbit coupling. Now, I think the most compelling evidence that we do have a topological state is if you look at a thin enough layer, so this is 45 angstrom, and you look at what is the longitudinal conductivity. I guess there are better plots that really show the magnitude, but you basically get the quantized magnitude of the resistivity. So the conductivity, which is 1 over that, should be E squared over H, and we have 2 from coming from the two edges of the sample. And basically, they see that to pretty good accuracy. This is a log plot, and they can show that. But there are many more experiments, and the materials are more clean in three dimensions. And this is an experiment from the Stanford group of Aaron Kapitonik. There are two things here. So first of all, this is bismuth tellurite. This is what the unit cell looks like. And this is the dispersion of the states on the edge. So if you remember, let me just say a little word. When we had graphene, we had two Dirac points. Then we added the spin orbit coupling, and we opened up a gap. So from something that looked like a massless Dirac point, we got into a massive Dirac point-like spectrum. But then we basically found edge modes. So if this was Dirac in 2D with a mass, here we have again Dirac, because the dispersion is linear. the mass is equal to zero for the edge modes, and the dimension is reduced, so it's 2D minus 1. So we have a one-dimensional. In three dimensions, a very similar thing happens, and the edge modes basically meet at some point in the Brillouin zone, and they have a Dirac point, which is massless. So on the edge of a three-dimensional topological insulator, we're going to get a Dirac-like spectrum in two dimensions. And I think I told you before that Dirac points must come in pairs, but the pairs could be separated. So we can have an odd number of Dirac points on one edge and another odd number on the other edge. And this is a plot. So a two-dimensional Dirac point is going to look something like that. So this is the energy, and this plane is the kx, ky plane. Okay? What is shown here is actually slicing of that dispersion. So you see slices, you see the contours of constant energy. And let me remind you how ARPES is done. Basically, we shine light on a sample, an electron comes out, and we can, through the conservation of momentum and energy, we can tell how many electrons come from which part of the Brillouin zone at a given energy. And of course, if we had sharp quasiparticles with no interactions or no disorder, we would just get a single delta function wherever there is a particle at E of k equals that energy and for a given momentum. But of course, there's sometimes some more incoherent part. And we call that the spectral function, and this is what ARPES measures. So basically, this slicing is done by setting the energy of the incoming photon. It determines the energy of the outgoing electron. And what we see here is very similar to a Dirac point because it's kind of round. And it means that the energy that is probed here is very close to the Dirac point. However, when they increase the energy, you see that, you know, still we have something like a circle, but there's some shape here. And it's called trigonal warping. So basically, we get some distortion that has to do with the symmetries of the lattice. And there's even more and more distortion. And this actually affects many things. I think my computer might have died. Okay. Yeah. This is actually the same, it's actually always the same data. They scan the energy and they scan the momentum. So this is now looking at the dispersion from this direction. And you can see that there is a Dirac point. However, there's more than just surface in this picture. So what you can see the beginning of, and you can't see the rest, are some bulk bends. So these are the bulk valence bands. If the Fermi level is here, then all of these bulk bands are full. And and these are surface states. And up here you have the bulk conduction band. So the band structure is not as pretty as one would envision, but indeed at some point there is a gap opening in the bulk system. And in that gap we have linearly dispersing surface states. And actually, the Dirac point is almost covered by the bulk bands. So that also happens here. Now, what this group is kind of experts on is STM. And they measure the local density of states. But now what they analyze is something similar to scattering off of a one-dimensional boundary. And the way they do it is they find in their sample a point where there's a step. So it's not really an edge, it's just a step. And they ask, what are the oscillations that are induced by that? So you can just think of it as a semi-classical object coming in, scattering off. So very similar to what we did with the impurity in graphene, but this time it's a one-dimensional edge. So basically you can, if this was a perfect step, you would maybe see processes from going in to going out in the opposite direction. This is just a sample of how the density looks like in at a given energy. Now we can take this and you see that there is oscillations in the density of states. These are called Friedel oscillations and they come from these scattering processes. And usually these oscillations just give us 2K Fermi. So we talked about it in a different context, but if I had a Fermi circle and I'm somewhere on the Fermi circle, then to get somewhere else and keep the same energy, I go 2K Fermi. Or there are other processes too, like here, but this is the dominant process. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm somehow not understanding what exactly is plugged in the picture that's table A. So you have, this is a three-dimensional material, right? So is X, Y, and Z are directions in the material?
Yeah, so basically what you see here is a topographic image of the sample. So STM can work in two modes, either measure the density of states or just measure the height. And what they measure here is they just scan the area and they see that there's a height drop. So they conclude that there's a sharp drop in
the sample. So the surface of the material physically looks like that?
Yeah. So these materials you saw, they're three-dimensional, but they're quasi-2D. They're not very good quasi-2D because they're not really layered with a huge separation between layers, but the way they grow is layer by layer. So sometimes a layer doesn't cover exactly the layer below, and you end up with a step. And this is what's happening here. And from the conceptual point of view, you can think of this step as just being a boundary condition, and you can study what happens in that boundary condition. And we do see some modulations. And now they scan the different energies. And let me guide you through that. So if you look, let's cut the data here, okay? So this axis is the density of states. This axis would be the energy. And the energy does something like that, okay? There's a kink somewhere, because it's not really a Dirac-like dispersion. But this is the profile of density of states for these edge modes. So almost Dirac-like. And we're somewhere above the Dirac point, so we see something like that in our system. We can't really reach the Dirac point because of the bulk bands. But now on this axis, we move away from the step. So as we look at this direction, perpendicular to the step, we see modulations in the density of states. And I think one is at the other, at the step that is down. Two is the region where we're in between, we're just climbing the step. And three is this region. Now, I don't know if it's easy to see from here, but basically, I think it's more apparent in this region. The modulations in the density of states start at a higher energy. If we look here at the lower energy, we don't see much modulations. And this is a consequence of the fact that we have a Dirac-like model. Because if we are at a low energy, we just have this structure of Dirac-like. And if you remember, when we analyzed graphene, for example, we said that here the pseudo spin of graphene is up and here it's down. Actually, here it's the real spin that is up and down. And this main process of scattering just cannot happen because there is no overlap between these two wave functions. So as long as our dispersion is Dirac-like, we can we basically cancel the modulations and we don't see much. So in this region, you don't see much happening. But as we cross some point, we do see modulation. And let's just go back one slide up, two slides. I think the point would be somewhere around here. So in this situation, the Fermi surface is for the edge modes is sort of circular. It's still sort of circular here. At this point, it's not the same. So maybe the spin here and the spin here is opposite, but there are more special vectors that one can look at. For example, all of this region here is kind of flat, so many processes can happen from here to here, from here to here, and so on. And the spin is not exactly opposite because of that trigonal warping. We actually don't know exactly what the spin does. But it's not exactly opposite, and we have some probability to scatter. And this is what you see in the higher energy region right here. And this is bismuth tellurite, one of the first 3D topological insulators. Another thing, so ARPES that I mentioned before, I think was developed really rapidly after the discovery of high-TC superconductivity. Again, it's something that's suitable for two-dimensional probing, and efforts really ramped up and people built amazing ARPES probes, and they're used in light sources, so you need high-energy light source for that. But recently, topological insulators, since we have this Dirac-like spectrum that we want to probe, since we think that there's a non-trivial texture to the spin, it encourages people to look into spin-resolved ARPES. So not only do we resolve where the particle is coming from in momentum space, what is the energy, we can also probe what is the spin. And it turns out that, I think this is bismuth antimony, this is the profile of edge modes. So it's way more complicated than what we've seen before, but you can think of one Dirac point here, one here, some more pockets here, but this is what you see on the surface, and you can actually map out the spin, and you find that the spin here, for example, is pointing down, and here it's pointing up. And you can cut it along a certain line, and you see that there are bulk bands below and above, and the edge modes usually start and end in the bulk bands or in the edge of the Brillouin zone. And the question is, when you put a Fermi energy, how many states are going to cross the Fermi energy? This is going to tell us how much current we have. Because if we have two states in opposite directions with the same spin, they're going to just hybridize and annihilate each other. And this is a plot that tells you basically what you're seeing here, that they can identify the spin here and the spins here. And there are actually pretty good numerical calculations that can simulate that very easily. Okay. Questions about experiments? Okay. Yeah.
It sounds weird, but what would be like an application of quantum theory in the future if they manage to prove it?
So I don't know exactly what it will be, but usually when you have current that is so robust, you would think that it's useful, because most currents are dissipative. So that is one lead. Another thing is that before this business of the quantum spin Hall effect, there was, I think around 2000, there was big hype for spintronics. So those were devices that also had spin orbit coupling, and you could find a spin Hall effect that wasn't quantized. And the idea of spintronics was that maybe you can replace electronics by spintronics. Maybe you can manipulate things on a much smaller scale and much more accurately. So if this thing can be ramped up to be of production quality, then maybe you can do spintronics with something like that. But it's way more robust because it doesn't scatter into the bulk. But, you know, we never know. Okay. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused about that expression in the code and you did it yesterday as well. When you connect these two codes and introduce gaps there, and then you say that you've got air states, but I just can't connect this K like reciprocal space fixture to the. Because I guess by air states you mean the actual physical green space.
Let me draw a few more pictures. So if I wanted to draw let's say I have the two-dimensional KX, KY and I have the Brillouin zone somewhere here, before I added the gap, I just had 2 points where the dispersion, and this is going to be the dispersion, was Dirac-like. Okay? But now, assume that even though I have translational symmetry, I just want to plot everything in terms of kx. So what I will see is, so now I want to plot this again, but maybe do it again. So what I will see is that as a function of kx, I have many bands, and the different bands correspond to different KYs. However, so this is now going to be KX, and this is going to be energy. So since I'm collapsing everything on the KX axis, I'm actually going to see many, many bands here. I only drew the big contour before. Okay? So I collapsed it. But now, if I want to introduce an edge, I can still use that picture. And when I introduce an edge, nothing actually happens to the bulk bands. They stay the way they are. I just get maybe more edge states, and this is the edge states we saw for graphene. In terms of kx, I can still define them. They had zero energy, and they were in those k's. Now, the same thing happens if I have a mass. When I have a mass, all of my bands are curving up before they meet the axis. Okay, so I still have that. And I have edge modes that I can still talk about their momentum. So I have their they have a momentum and they have energy as a function of momentum. And their energy as a function of momentum, this one, E is equal kx. And for this one, E is equal minus kx around this point, so maybe I have to shift my kx. Okay, so this is how I talk about it in momentum space, even though it's edges. So they all fall on the same plot because I didn't show you the other dimension. But what I know is that if I look at the wave functions, all of these are actually spread over the entire sample, also in the y direction. But these ones are actually localized on the edges, one on one edge, the other on the other edge. Okay, so if it's not clear, we can talk about it more. Yeah?
Can you just explain again why the word topological and topological interface, what does it refer to? Is it topology of the sample or is it a more abstract?
It's the topology of the wave functions. It's whether the wave functions are doing something interesting. And I'm today going to introduce the Berry phase, and you'll see that it's analogous to what I spoke about on Monday. So basically, you can take the sketches that we drew on Monday as the definition of the topology. Whether you can map your system onto something that wraps around or doesn't.
And in those cases, so when you can wrap around the plane around the sphere, then it's not really a sphere, is that right? Like, would it be better to draw a single value field on a different topology object?
We'll see. Let me know if you still have trouble with that after I introduce the Berry phases. Okay, so Berry phase. We have in quantum mechanics this redundancy. We know that we have let's say I have an eigenstate of some system. I know it's only defined up to some phase. And the phases, an overall phase usually doesn't matter. What does matter is sometimes relative phases. But what I can imagine is that I have my Hamiltonian, and that it's a function of some parameters, R1 to Rn. Okay, this doesn't have to be real space, it's just some parameters. And let me assume that I change the parameters slowly in time. So when I say slowly, what I mean is that if I started with a quantized spectrum and I choose one of these eigenstates and I change the parameter slowly, levels don't cross. Okay? So I do it in an adiabatic way and I can just follow my states. In a gap system, it's of course well defined too. So that's what it means to do it adiabatically. And then the question is, what happens to the wave function? So what I want to say is that at any given point in time, my wave function, phi n of t, well, let me change notation a little bit. I would say that n of r of t is the instantaneous ground state. Okay? So I at every point in time, I'm choosing an R. So I have a Hamiltonian. And I can diagonalize it. And this would be an eigenstate. And I have many of them. But now, I want to take my parameters and change them slowly and still follow the state that I started with. So what can happen? What do you think will happen when I change the parameters of the system? So the adiabatic theorem tells me that at any given point, my state that I just took and evolved this state would still be an eigenstate of the system, of the instantaneous system. So if I do this, change this parameter r with time, whenever I take a snapshot, the wave function I have is an eigenstate of the instantaneous Hamiltonian that I have at that time. Okay? But what I don't know is the phase. And let me write down a phase that I want to suggest for this. So I'll call it gamma n times e to the I over h bar, an integral from 0 to tau. And 0 is the time I started, en tau prime d tau, dt prime, times n of that particular time. Yeah. Yeah, so let's assume the ground state is not degenerate. And I'm assuming that I can really follow one state, that I'm not crossing levels. Yeah. It will complicate things, yeah, a lot. And it leads to some interesting effects, actually. So why do I divide it like that to two kind of phase contributions? The reason is, imagine that I'm changing parameters, but actually nothing changes in the Hamiltonian. So I'm changing something that's not relevant to the Hamiltonian. And I follow that curve, then what I should expect to get is just E, a phase of minus I over H bar, E times T, right? So this phase reduces to the phase that I will get if I'm just at a stationary state and I'm not changing anything. Okay? So this phase is called the dynamical phase. However, we have another phase, which at this point we don't know anything about. And we call it the Berry phase. And for many years, people ignored it. And let me tell you why they ignored it. So first, let's try to derive this phase. What I want to do is the following. I know that d dt of my psi of t is equal to h of t psi of t. And now everything is dependent on t through the parameters r. Okay, I just didn't write it explicitly. But I want to just operate with the derivative on this. And what I get is the following. I get ih times I d gamma dt, gamma n dt, minus I over h epsilon n of t times the same function I had before. But I have another time dependence, which comes here. So I have plus that whole phase, so dynamical n Berry phase, I over h minus epsilon n dt. Yeah. That's right.
I just want to make sure I understand what you're doing. So the r are positions?
No, they're not positions. They are just some parameters of my theory. I didn't say what they are. They might be positions. They might be something else. Something that I can change slowly in time.
Okay, and n of r?
And n of r is an instantaneous eigenstate. So let's assume
of the Hamiltonian.
So this is r. It's all of the parameters.
Okay.
So it's like you take the Hamiltonian at a given time. It's defined by r of t. By all of the parameters, you diagonalize, you get this wave function. Okay? So basically now I also have dt of n of r of t. And this is equal to, since I'm just applying the Hamiltonian to an eigenstate, this is equal to n of t times psi. Okay? So just from looking at this, and I can multiply everything by n of r from the left, and basically I get the following. I get that, sorry, there is ih also here. I get that I d gamma n dt is equal to n of r of t dt n of r of t. And I think I might want to define it with a minus sign.
So when we substitute things into the Schrodinger equation, then we assume that gamma n's and the epsilon n's are unknown and do not determine them, right?
Sorry, so it's this.
I guess.
Sorry, say that again.
So.
I don't know gamma n.
Right? We don't know gamma
n. I don't know gamma n, but.
Okay.
But I can still say something about it from this Schrodinger, time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And I found the following. I found that that actually this is equal to that. And I can write, okay, so I found this. I found the time derivative of that phase. Okay, this is just a consequence. So it's different than the dynamical phase because the dynamical phase will really cancel by the Hamiltonian. So it's sort of more intuitive. And for many years, people just analyzed this dynamical phase. But there's some significance to the Berry phase. And let me write, do one more step. So basically, what I want to do is integrate over time from, let's say, 0 to t. And I get that gamma n is I times the integral dt prime from 0 to t of n of r dt prime n of r. But I want to write this in a different way. Since the dependence here on t is just through r, I can write it, I can write this as dr dt, this is a vector, dotted into n of r, gradient of r, this is another vector, of n of r again. So I just want to express everything. And it tells you right away that you don't even have to do the integral over time. You can do the integral in parameter space. So if there's some contour that you're going around, it doesn't have to be closed, but if you're going around some trajectory in R space, then what you want to do is just take dr along that trajectory and dot it with this. And this might look to you like some gauge field. So by analogy to what happens in a magnetic field, this would look like I'm going along in the trajectory and accumulating a phase according to some gauge field that I have in the system. And we call it the Berry connection. So you see right away that the functions need to be somewhat interesting in order for that to not cancel. So the functions have to do something as a function of this r so that we get some non-trivial Berry phase. Now, if I call that A, let's say, and this is some vector potential, then, of course, I can always do a transformation, e to the I, psi of r, n of r, instead of n of r. You know, just do some sort of transformation. And then A will go to A plus gradient of psi, right? So for that reason, people thought, and that was, I think, in the 70s, that maybe we should just leave that whole Berry phase alone because maybe we can just gauge it out. I can always, on any trajectory, I can just define this function. But it turns out that you can define something that is gauge invariant, that will not be that you'll not be able to gauge it away like that. And that something is what you get if you close your trajectory, if you make a loop. So basically, now I can do the same thing and define my gamma n on a closed loop, and I get, and I have this, times A. And this is gauge invariant, because the only thing that I can add now is going to be this psi at the r that I finishing the trajectory minus psi at the r of the initial point of the trajectory, but they have to be the same. Okay, because we have a closed trajectory, so we cannot just gauge it out. And there's I want to put an index n everywhere, which means that whenever I have a band that I can really follow, I can do this for whatever band I have that in my motion in parameter space does not cross anything else. And I think I've forgotten I here in the definition. Okay? So this is the definition of the Berry connection. But now, if I close the loop, it makes more sense to define the curl of this vector potential. And I call it the Berry curvature. And the Berry curvature is, let's call it omega mu nu is dr mu of a nu, a n nu, minus dr nu of a mu. So this is the Berry curvature, and I can replace this integral by surface integral ds dot the curl of A. Stokes theorem, you can always do that. So this is the Berry curvature. You can also define a vector, so this is a tensor, but you can define a vector such that let's say epsilon mu nu rho. So this is the total antisymmetric tensor times the vector omega, which would be like a magnetic field associated with that vector potential. But the rho component of it is going to be omega mu nu. Okay? And there's summation over indices that are the same. Okay? So these are all just definitions. Now, maybe I should also mention, but not very important for us today, that sometimes it's not simple to work with the wave functions, and you want something that's defined on the Hamiltonian. So you can write the Berry connection also on the Hamiltonian in the following way. You go over the states n prime that are not equal to m, and you calculate n dh dr mu n prime, multiply it by n prime. Okay, I don't have enough space here. Sorry. So, starting here, so I have n dh dr mu n prime, and then n prime dh dr nu n, and you anti-symmetrize, so you're going to take minus the same thing with n with nu goes to mu. Okay, so you just anti-symmetrize this. And you have to divide by En minus En prime squared. Yeah. So this is just an equivalent way of writing the Berry curvature. It's convenient when you're doing calculations sometimes, because you can just work with a Hamiltonian, and then you don't have to work with eigenmodes. You can do it for any state, basically. It's especially convenient if, in the end of the day, you want to sum up over all the bands. Then this just becomes a trace. So then it doesn't really matter which modes, which basis you're looking at. But let me just now stop here for a second and make a connection with what we've seen before. So a two-level system is a little special. And I want to describe the Hamiltonian in the same way we did on Monday. And write it as a vector times the, so my Hamiltonian, let's write it here, the Hamiltonian in some space is just going to be some kind of a D vector. Well, let's call it H, because we might have too many D's, times the Pauli matrices, and I'm allowing the Pauli matrices to be three-dimensional. Okay? So if this is my Hamiltonian, and I can, of course, write psi dagger psi, and there's some, it could be a function of k, or it could be a function of something else, but I can write it this way, so that would be hk. Now I'm imagining that since the momentum is a good quantum number here, that maybe I can start with an eigenstate in some momentum and slowly over time change the momentum and close the loop and get the Berry phase of that kind of loop. Maybe I need to stop for a second and just say that you can define it in momentum space on any contour, so you'll have some Berry phase associated with a momentum space, and you'll have dq dotted into un of q. So u here, u is my eigenmode, gradient of q, un of q, and you sometimes want to do an integral over the whole Brillouin zone of dq times the Berry curvature. So let me write it down. So the Berry curvature is just going to be grad q cross this n of q, grad q, n of q. And you can also show that this is the same as, in two dimensions, we can even write it in a bit more compact way. We'll get to that. Yeah?
Could you explain, what is that, in your expression for omega mu, what is the thing after the minus sign on top of the fraction?
Here?
Yeah.
So I'm just anti-symmetrizing. So I'm going to take the same expression again, minus the expression with mu and mu replaced.
Oh, okay.
So it's just an anti-symmetric combination. Okay?
Yeah. Can you explain how we can
direct it? This one? I could explain that. Let me see if I want to explain it. you have to remember that these are eigenmodes to do that. So, so basically, if you insert H times something else, it's just like En prime H. And that gives you these factors here that you eventually have to divide by. I can show you a derivation. And actually, there probably is a derivation in one of the papers that I'm going to put online, one by Xiao and Nu. So there's a review paper. It's a bit involved, but the beginning is kind of what we're doing now, and is but it shouldn't be very complicated. So I just want to get to one point here. And the point is such, if we have this vector, I want to show you that this that this very phase, gamma n, is going to be half of the solid angle that our vector h is going to cover in the process. So we assume that we had before that unit vector, and let's say we have our h, and along our contour, when we change our parameters, it does some sort of a circle, we can define a solid angle that is covered in that motion. And actually, the Berry phase is going to be half the solid angle. So let's do that. First of all, what are the eigenstates of this? So H is actually sine theta sine phi, sine theta cos phi, and cos theta. I just wrote it in polar coordinates. Yeah. No. Then it's defined in a different way. Then it's defined in the plane. How is it? You can just reduce. It actually will be reduced in the same way. I mean, you can define the Berry phase. Here, I didn't specify any kind of dependence on parameters. Here, I'm just taking one special system. Yeah.
So, what is the thing that subtends the solid angle again? Like you have a solid angle, which gives you the Berry phase, but
how do I get this solid angle?
Yeah, what's the solid angle?
So I start. I want to do my gamma n is some integral on a loop in parameter space of some vector field, right? Along the loop, right? So I'm going around the loop, but as I go around the loop and change parameters. If my parameters are, say, the k's that describe, that define the h, then h also does some motion, and the vector that is just the direction of h draws some trajectory on the unit sphere. And then this area will define the solid angle. Okay?
I just want to understand the application of this phase.
We haven't gotten to the application of this phase. We'll see that it has some implications for topological insulators, basically. The idea would be that we can distinguish between something that is a trivial insulator and a topological insulator using this phase. Okay, but let me just say that when we have a Hamiltonian like that, we have two eigenmodes, and you can check that and see that you can write them in the following way. They actually don't depend on the magnitude of the vector. And they look like that. Sorry, cosine theta over 2 e to the minus I phi and sine theta over 2 and psi minus is sine theta over 2 e to the minus I phi and cosine minus cosine theta over 2. And now what I want to do is calculate the Berry phase. And I already told you before that I don't have to worry about how time changes, right? The only thing I care about is how my Hamiltonian changes with the parameters. And in this case, instead of calculating the Berry phase in momentum space, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take gamma n to be on the trajectory, and it's going to be the Berry curvature with respect to theta and phi, and I'm going to take d theta d phi. Okay, so basically what I'm doing here is I'm going to integrate over the Berry curvature, but instead of expressing it in momentum space, I express it through the parameters of this h, through the angles of this h. I could have started with momentum and then do a coordinate transformation and ended up here. But I'm just making a shortcut and doing it here. So now all we need to do is find out what is omega theta phi. And omega theta phi is d theta a phi minus d phi a theta. So we have to ask ourselves, what is the gauge field, the Berry connection? And A theta is going to be given by, and let's do the plus, okay? Let's just do it for the plus wave function. We can do the same for the minus. But it's going to be just I psi plus d theta psi plus. So let's calculate it. So first I have to take the derivative of the first coordinate, and it's going to give me minus sine theta over 2 times a half. And then I have to multiply by the coordinate of psi that I didn't take the derivative of, so it's going to be cosine theta over 2. And I have an I here. And now I need to take the derivative of this. So I'm going to have a plus cosine of theta over 2 times a half times sine theta over 2. And then I end up with a 0 for A theta. And for A phi, I have to do the same thing, but just take the derivative with respect to phi. And this is easier because all I have to do is look at this thing. So d phi of e to the I minus I phi is just minus I. So I have I times a minus I times cosine squared of theta over 2. Okay? And I think that cosine squared of theta over 2 is actually half sine of theta. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. Sorry? Oh, I have a 1 here. Okay. 1 minus. I actually don't care about the 1 because I'm going to take a derivative of this. Yeah. So is there a half here, just for the records? Okay. So now we have A phi. We have A theta, which is 0. So our Berry curvature is just going to be d theta of sine theta, of half sine theta. And what I get is, let's just, you know what, let's just leave it at this. That would make my life easier. So now I'll just take the derivative, and I know that theta is actually the derivative. So I have 2 cosine theta over 2 times sine of theta over 2 times a half. So what I get is that this is actually sine theta, so I get half sine of theta. Okay? Minus? Okay. up to minus signs. And now, when I take the theta d phi of this curvature, I get a minus half in front times sine theta. And you can already recognize that this is the solid angle. So if I integrated that over the sphere, I would get 4 pi. But so basically, the Berry, this is going to be our Berry phase. And the Berry phase is half times the solid angle that we trace in the parameter space as we do this. Now, I want to say two more things about that. If you take a specific H that looks like, so if H would be something like X, Y, Z, this would look like as if you're and you will integrate over the whole space, it will look like you have a monopole, a magnetic monopole in your system. And the integration is going to tell you how much charge there is of the monopole. So I'm not doing it here. It's done in that review paper. But basically, you'll see that this leads to a Berry phase, gamma n, which is half times the solid angle of the full contour around your monopole times the number times some integer number. And it turns out that so this is going to be 4 pi divided by 2 times n, so it's actually 2 pi times the charge you have in your system. So n is a charge, the charge of the monopole. But let's leave that aside for now. I want to say something else, which I don't have time for, so maybe I'll finish next time. But if you took the problem set that you had yesterday and you wanted to calculate the Berry phase, you can immediately see that it actually has a non-trivial Berry phase, and the Berry phase is 2 pi. And we call the a number, let's call it the Chern number, is going to be the accumulated Berry phase over the whole Brillouin zone. So when we just go around the whole Brillouin zone, divided by 2 pi. And in the case you did yesterday, you're going to get 1. And usually for any insulator that you will do that exercise, you'll get 0 for any non-topological. And let me just motivate why is that. So you had a matrix like that, sine kx plus I sine ky, and sine kx minus I sine ky. And you had here m of k, and m of k looked like that. In the topological case, it had a minus sign, so a negative value that was small, plus beta times 2 minus cos kx minus cos ky. Okay, so what we're going to do now is just going to schematically look at the Brillouin zone and see where our vector is pointing, where the vector that defines the potential. So our vector is going to have this as hx, this is hz, and this is hy. Okay? Now you see that this function, so let me just draw the Brillouin zone. So this function, when I look at kx equals 0, these two are just 1, So this whole term cancels, and we end up with a negative m. And these two cancel too. So if I look at where is my vector pointing, it's pointing in the south pole. Okay? It only has a z component, and the z component is negative at this point. So here, it's pointing at the south pole. Now, if I put, let's say, kx and ky equals pi, I get 2 plus 2, so I get 4 beta, which are greater than the minus m, so it becomes positive. And again, these hx and hy are 0. So if I look at the corners of the Brillouin zone, and it doesn't matter which corner, I'm at the south pole. And the same actually happens when I take one of the kx and ky to be 0 and the other to be pi, I also get something like that. Okay? Sorry, north pole. Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. It has to be opposite. So all of them point in the north pole because this term, the beta term, overturns the sign of the mass. Yeah, thanks. So now I just want to draw, and if you look at what happens, so let's say I'm looking at this line, then kx is 0, ky is 0, and kx changes, and it actually changes sign, because I have, hx changes sign, because I have sine kx. And if I look at what happens on the unit sphere, I basically just don't go anywhere. I start here, I go there, I come back, I go there and come back. So I didn't cover anything. I just canceled what I did. But if I look at a place where ky is slightly above 0, then the motion is going to be in the zy direction if I look here. So I'm just going to draw a circle here that takes me from the north to the south pole and back. But not exactly. So I will have, a positive, a slightly positive z direction, but I also have a y direction. And as you scan, as you go along these, you'll see that basically you're making contours and you're rotating them so that you're changing, and eventually you're going to cover the whole unit sphere. It takes some, you have to actually sit down and look at what these things are doing. But you can do a nice exercise just taking one of these lines and trying to trace the contour and see what it does. Yeah.
So did you just map this sheet onto the sphere? Continuously?
What do you mean continuously?
Is the map from the sheet onto the sphere, is it continuous?
Yeah. I mean, I have points where it's not one-to-one correspondence.
Okay?
It's not. Because I can trace back what I did, and I can, I can go around. And so I think it looks like, drawing a circle and sort of rotating it around. So you have special points. Yes.
So could you draw it on something that's not a sphere and have a single value too?
I don't really know how to do that. I mean, this is just a picture, but you have a mathematical object to work with. But I think this picture works well in the sense that you know whether you cover it or don't cover. And in your motion, you can go back and forth. But in the end, there's just an area that you cover. I mean, you can see from this analogy that there is really an area. And this is unique to two-level systems, the fact that you can map it like that. Yeah, okay, so sorry I went over time. We're going to continue next time.